Morning again. Our first case, or second case for argument rather, Dupuy v. Samuels, Mr. Lehrer.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Lehrer and I represent the plaintiff's appellants, who are parents and their children, which is why we refer to them as the Dupuy families. The safety plans at issue in this appeal always involve very extensive deprivation.
Now, I couldn't figure out, among other things, the relation between this case and other pending litigation that seems to be dealing with the same issues, and also what is exactly the injunction here? I couldn't find the injunction that you're appealing from.
Well, the injunction itself, I don't think it's much of an injunction.
Asking you what you think of it. I'd just like to see the injunction in one place. I haven't seen it in one place.
The injunction is at A62 and following.
Page 62?
A62 and following. It's the appendix to our brief.
I don't see that. It's captioned order, and it's a discussion. And it says approves the DCFC proposal with certain modifications. So where's the injunction?
The injunction is the...
It's some combination of documents here, right?
The injunction is the directive of with certain modifications...
Yeah, where's the injunction? Where's the document? If someone violated if someone was accused of violating the injunction, where would you go and have a piece of paper and say, this is the injunction, this is the conduct alleged to violate it, it does or doesn't violate it?
The closest it comes, I would say, would be in the letter.
The parties ask to have an injunction set forth on one piece of paper so everyone would know what it provided without looking between different documents?
Both parties, I believe, deemed this order to be the injunction. Certainly the district court did. On the very last page, A65, it says, with these modifications, which Your Honor referred to, the court adopts the department's proposals.
Yeah, well, that's unlawful. Rule 65D says an injunction shall not refer to any other document. Right? It's perfectly clear there has to be one document with all terms in it. No cross-references are allowed. And I have some of my colleagues' concerns. You and the state, for that matter, should have asked the district court to comply with Rule 65D for your own good as well as for ours.
I appreciate the comment. I do think when the court says, with these modifications, the court adopts the department's proposals, which it does summarily describe
so
as its order.
So unprofessional.
And then it's
not thinking. You're not thinking ahead to if a compliance problem arose, you'd like to have the injunction in one place, one document, so it would be easy to determine what it actually provided.
Okay. Especially in light of Your Honor's comment, that definitely would
inform. Reading the rules, enter injunction, Rule 65.
The court then does say, the district court directs the department to implement these new procedures, which it has summarily described.
Look, how does this litigate, this appeal from a preliminary injunction, how does this relate to all the other stuff that is going on?
There are three phases of the Dupuy litigation, and it's been twice in this court. The first phase concerned the rights
of... What's going on now, my question?
Right
is.
Now, there's a trial on the merits of the entire case set for October 16th. And the entire case is what was discussed in Dupuy 1, this court's opinion about child care employees. Parties referred to this aspect of the case as Dupuy 2.
What is the relation between this preliminary injunction appeal and this trial starting on October 16th?
This is a preliminary injunction regarding safety plans. The trial on October 16th is a trial on the merits of the entire case. As a matter of fact, the court, pursuant to Rule 65...
So the trial encompasses the issues here?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, it encompasses the record here, because pursuant to Rule 65, the court admitted stuff that would otherwise be admissible, substantially the entire Dupuy 1 and Dupuy 2 hearing records are already a matter, already part of the trial record for purposes of the trial.
Now, there also, I gather, there's compliance going on, right? Compliance with this injunction? What's that about?
This injunction, there's a reporting order which obliges them, which is not before the court, was entered after the appeal here, which obliges them to report on their compliance with the preliminary injunction. There's been no compliance proceedings with that.
You're appealing from the preliminary injunction,
yes.
But they're complying with it? What's that about?
Well, they didn't ask for a stay of the preliminary injunction.
Yeah, but you're challenging the preliminary injunction, aren't you?
We're challenging the preliminary injunction as insufficient, yes. It did not. The district court entered a declaratory.
So they're content with the injunction. They're complying.
Right.
They are absolutely content.
You want the injunction broadened.
Right. We want it considerably broadened.
The rationale of their brief implies that the injunction should be vacated, but they have not filed a cross appeal.
That's correct.
They can't get any relief.
That is correct. And there are. The principle, really, their only argument in that is that everyone in the class waived all their due process rights, and so they had no due process rights in the first place.
No, their principal argument isn't that they waived their due process rights. Their argument, as I understand it, is that their alternative to a safety plan is a hearing in court, and that satisfies the due process clause. That's not a waiver point. It's a proposition that the state offers due process and it has a court system to supply it.
That is an additional argument that they make, but it's let me respond to that. That argument, respectfully, has no merit. The hearing that they're talking about is a temporary custody hearing in the state courts, and the issue there is whether the court should retain custody over the child,
yes,
that is taken protective custody of in most cases.
Yeah.
It is not a hearing in any way on the safety plan. The safety plan has nothing to do with it.
But I don't understand why that matters. I mean, suppose the state says, if you don't take out, suppose the state says, we propose to condemn your property and we propose to pay you $50,000. And if you don't take that, we'll file a condemnation action, and the court will award condemnation, which may be less than $50,000 or greater. And the property owner takes the $50,000. Can he say, I'm entitled to a hearing that violated due process because I took the $50,000 cash rather than going to court, where the question won't be whether I get $50,000. There'll be independent appraisers.
What entitles the person to a hearing here is that there's been a deprivation through the safety plan of...
No, why don't you address my question? I mean, take my hypothetical. There's going to be a deprivation. The state ends up with the property owner's property, and he ends up with $50,000. But no one would say, I suppose, that you need a hearing before that can happen, because the property owner can say, I refuse, take me to court.
Because
that's the state's argument here. Why is your case any different?
When the state deprives you of liberty, you're entitled to a hearing on the merits of what they did. When the state...
I just don't understand that.
In
my condemnation case, there will be no hearing on the question whether $50,000 is the right amount. What the hearing will be about is, what would a willing buyer and willing seller at arm's length pay for this property? It will not be an inquiry into whether $50,000 was the right amount.
With all due respect, Judge, when the state deprives you of a protected liberty interest, as they do here through the safety plan, indeed through a coerced choice, and if you're entitled to process, it's process on the legitimacy of what the state did to you. In this court...
All right. Well, then, can you explain to me why, in the condemnation case, you do not get a hearing on the question whether $50,000 is the right amount? What you get is a hearing on a different question, which is, what was the property worth? Right? This happens all the time, right? The defendant the plaintiff goes to the defendant and says, if you don't pay me $1 million, I'll file this tort suit and seek $1 billion in punitive damages. If the suit is filed, there won't be any question about the propriety of paying $1 million.
Okay. What we're essentially complaining about here, and I am trying to be responsive to your question, is the illegality of the imposition of these safety plans. And what makes the imposition illegal, our principal argument is that the state doesn't have the constitutionally requisite evidence to impose the safety plans in the first place. And it doesn't have it because of what this court said in Brokaw and then reaffirmed in Doe. So the procedural due process question.
But isn't it true that if the parent refuses the safety plan, they have a right to a hearing before the child is taken away?
No.
But they have a right to a hearing within 48 hours after that, don't they?
Okay. If the state seizes the child, right? Well, let me point out first.
Parents turn down the safety plan. Now, what happens next?
Okay. Let me mention one fact. As the district court found, the state was unable to identify even a single plan among 70,000.
I asked you a very simple question.
What happens next is that they're supposed to get a hearing in the state juvenile court on temporary custody, where the state can retain custody of the child. Right. It's not a hearing on the safety plan.
I understand. Is there anything inadequate about that hearing? So it's like a probable cause hearing. What is it that troubles you about the hearing?
There's nothing inadequate about the hearing so far as whether the state retains temporary custody, but there's everything inadequate about the hearing insofar as it's not a hearing on the safety plan. They're entitled to a hearing on the merits of what the state did to them. And in all these cases, remember, no one ever takes protective custody. The state was unable to identify a single instance in which everyone had chosen that.
The kinds of questions we're asking you are, what is wrong with settling a dispute? A settlement is usually thought to be fine if the alternative here, go to court and contest custody, is lawful. You don't have a hearing on the settlement. You have a hearing on the lawful alternative. What? Are you disputing the legality of the state's go-to-court alternative?
Yes, exactly. And the district court did, too, though she didn't follow through with an injunction on it. What makes the so-called here choice illegal, the district court found, right, was that the state coerced those under an unlawful threat. It's unlawful under Heck. Heck holds that the state can't make threats of protective custody. It was actually a much vaguer threat in Heck. The state can't make threats of protective custody unless it has evidence.
Their threat is a bluff, right? You call their bluff by asking for a hearing.
It's very much a bluff. As a matter of fact,
if it's a bluff, you call their bluff, right?
And then there won't be a need for a safety plan. Let me give you another example. The police show up at your door and say, I want you to consent to a search of your place or show me where you keep the drugs. The alternative is I'll go get a warrant, and that will authorize me to tear this house apart, top to bottom, right? Pry all your panels open, look under the floorboards. You're better off consenting. Is there any problem with that transaction?
That's not this transaction, okay?
I understand that this does not involve a search and seizure.
It's not a matter of the search and seizure. It's the act of coercing. It's not a future threat.
I wish you'd answer my question as Judge Posner wished you'd answer his.
The threat itself, the district court found, is what vitiates these plans, okay? What also vitiates the plans...
Would you deign to answer my question?
I'll have to ask you to repeat the question, Judge. I'm sorry.
I give up. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you, if all these things are going to be hashed out in a trial that's going to start next month, why did you even take an appeal here? You don't have to take an appeal from this wherever this injunction is in the record, if there is one, you didn't have to appeal it.
That's correct. We didn't have to appeal, but in our view, you know, when we appealed, we didn't know when the trial would be. But more importantly, our clients are suffering, we believe, irreparable injury with this very limited injunction.
So what happens if this court takes the matter under advisement, and given this panel, you probably expect a fairly expeditious decision, but if you if we were to take a year to decide this case, you would have you'll try it next month, and all these issues, oh, this is a small part of that big picture that's going to be hashed out in the district court. It just seems like such a waste of time.
Well, it's the critical question, I think, is, you know, when Judge Palmer would decide the case. In this court's fee opinion, it noted that it's Dupuy 1 decision, the panel's Dupuy 1 decision, provided, they thought, substantial guidance to the district court. And I'm certainly not going to presume to speak for Judge Palmer, but she might be looking to this court for substantial guidance on the resolution of Dupuy 2 as well.
Do other states have similar systems with a safety plan and so on, or is this some unique Illinois experiment?
No, it's not a unique Illinois experiment. I understand they're quite common, though. I know of no other class challenge to this, and I see my time at
other. Common in other states?
Okay. Sorry?
Common in other states. Other states have these. It's not, okay. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lehrer. Ms. Greenspan?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barbara Greenspan. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent Director Samuels in this case. Thank you, Judge. The district court did not abuse its discretion in not giving.
Are you complying with the injunction?
We are. We are. And, Your Honor, for the court's edification, while I'd like to attempt to assist the court in finding the terms of the injunction, while they are not set forth as Rule 65 requires, the A1 to Appendix A1 to the defendant's brief contains Appendix G to the department's rule of procedure.
Is there any reason why you didn't ask the district court to comply with Rule 65? The idea of forcing anybody to start with page 62 and then go to Appendix A1 and get cross-referred to Appendix G, there's a reason why the rule expressly prohibits this, and we're looking at it.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't have a good reason. I just don't. I apologize to the court. The department does understand its obligations. The other piece of the injunction, and the court's, I'm not quarreling with the court. The other piece of it is set forth in that portion of the plaintiff's appendix that they pointed to earlier in Mr. Lehrer's argument. The point here, though, is that the district court did not abuse its discretion in not giving the plaintiffs more. The department is complying with the injunction. Well, it is set forth in several places, and we do apologize to the court and completely understand the court's comment with respect to Rule 65. The Constitution does not require more than the department is doing. The department balances the strong interests in protecting children with the rights of families and keeping families together. The question here is how do we keep children safe?
What did Judge Palmer enjoin so far as this appeal is concerned? What is the material part of her injunction?
The material part of her injunction is requiring, beyond that which the department had already agreed to do, had already started on it on its own, the district court required the department to provide some kind of a review of the terms of the safety plan during the investigation. This is the safety plan team assessment process that's described in the court's order. This, in conjunction with the every 5-day review, with providing notice of the basis for the safety plan, with an articulated duration of the safety plan, and a means for satisfying the terms of the safety plan.
So, in other words, if the department offers you a safety plan, you can ask or its terms to be reviewed before you decide whether to accede to it? Is that?
No, Your Honor. This is a post-deprivation, if you will, process. The process that
What, you agree to the safety plan and then you try to get it modified? Is that it?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually,
what she's requiring is it simply that the parents have an opportunity to seek modification of the safety plan?
Yes, parents have an opportunity to seek modification or to inform the department that they no longer wish to comply with the safety plan. That's always their option. Families always have the option to say no and put the department in a position of reassessing the home and determining whether it needs to take protective custody, which is a 48-hour duration.
This is just administrative review. This isn't judicial.
It is akin to an administrative.
Informal, yeah.
Yes, it is an informal process. The point of having the, and this is the process that the department had proposed in response to the court's order. It is an attempt to have a non-adversarial process because safety plans are intended to be non-adversarial. They're intended to be voluntary. They're intended to have the family work together with the department to keep the children safe during the investigation.
Now, how is the trial going to illuminate? I'm just following up on Judge Evans's question. So the trial is coming up in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. So is there going to be evidence directed toward this issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what would the evidence be?
The evidence will be the department's current practices with respect to safety planning. The evidence will be by way of expert testimony. And experts who we've already disclosed to the plaintiffs.
Will the issue of whether these are coercive be adjudicated in the district court?
I'm sure the district court will deal with that issue. It's certainly an issue that the plaintiffs have raised.
So when the safety order says that you may, that the district court could hear evidence and could conclude that that may really means shall.
She could. I don't think the court will. She certainly could hear evidence of that nature.
One of their arguments that they coerce people to accept the plan?
Yes, that is their argument. And they argue beyond that it is an unlawful coercion, and this is indeed not the fact. While the defendant does not challenge the safety plan, we didn't cross appeal. We do not believe that these safety plans are unlawfully coercive. They are based on a reasonable suspicion that the child is likely to be abused or neglected in the near future. That's the standard for safety plans. That's the standard that's set forth in the protocol that's administered in each investigation. The protocol provides the investigators with an organized way of evaluating the safety of the child at the earliest stages of the investigation. What we know from
I don't understand. You can always offer a safety plan, couldn't you? I don't understand. I thought the idea was you'd offer the safety plan if the alternative was that you were going to take the child, right?
Yes.
So the question isn't what basis you have for a safety plan, it's what basis you have for taking the child, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But safety plans are offered in instances where there is not an urgent and immediate necessity for removing the child. Safety plans are offered in instances where there's a determined...
turn it down, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You just turn it down, right?
They can just turn it down, of course. Yeah. Of course, they're free to say no. Families do. Safety plans are offered in instances when, after application of the protocol, there's been a determination based on the available evidence at that time that the child is at risk of being unsafe, of being harmed in the near future. Many states have safety planning processes. In fact, there was testimony by an expert in the trial that Illinois' safety planning process is looked at as a model. It was developed in conjunction with the American Humane Association as well as Action for Child Protection national organizations. The safety factors which plaintiffs attack are studied. The safety planning process itself, protocol, has been proven to reduce the recurrence of maltreatment of children. This is unrebutted. We would ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court and to dismiss the appeal of plaintiffs' request to review the court's 2004 class modification of the class definition. If the court has no further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Greenspan. So, Mr. Leary, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you have something urgent to say.
I appreciate the time. Ms. Greenspan said that they imposed these safety plans where they have reasonable suspicion. That's exactly what the district court found was not the case and what she gave a constitutional pass
suspicion.
To.
I don't need suspicion. Right? If they did, you don't need suspicion to offer somebody something.
It's not a matter of offering something. The district court found, as a matter of fact, that these plans were coerced. It wasn't simply a matter of offering. There's two problems here.
Well, what's the coercion consist of?
The coercion that the district court focused on was the threat of protective custody absent Brokaw evidence, right? Absent having the Brokaw evidence.
That's not coercion. I mean, we've been through this. Is there some real coercion?
Judge, with all due respect, in the Miller case, allowed the offer to stand there was that the state had probable cause to arrest. Here, the threat is all bound up with the fact that the state doesn't have Brokaw evidence either to impose the plan or to take protective custody.
How is it a credible threat if they don't have probable cause? Why doesn't the parent say,
Because the parent doesn't know that. The parent isn't even informed of what the allegations are against him, wrongdoing are. There's no information. The parent is never informed of these allegations. This isn't some proceeding where the evidence is laid out and then she gets to make an informed choice. No way does that happen.
Well,
they're presented with a plan.
Counsel, the Supreme Court has held in Schneckloff against Bustamante and Robinette against Ohio that's not required. The coercion question would be more interesting if there were a finding that DCFS officials systematically lie to parents about the quality of evidence or about their intent.
Did
the judge make such a finding?
In effect, yes, Judge.
Judge make such a finding?
Not in those terms, but she did make this finding. She credited the testimony of case manager Gold, who said that in cases which are ultimately unfounded, which are two-thirds of the cases, the chances that the state had enough evidence to take protective custody, which is the same standard of evidence used to impose the safety plan, was zero.
That's, of course, not his question.
But, well, I think
now,
it is.
Is this something on which you're going to present evidence of misrepresentation? Is this something at the trial you're going to present evidence, or have you finished with the evidence?
We've already presented substantial evidence, which is already part of the trial record. We'll be presenting some additional evidence on this.
Judge Evans has a question.
Am I right that this is a pretty small part of these investigations, that only a very small percentage of investigations end up in safety plans being executed?
They're implemented in approximately one-third of the cases that are investigated, but that amounts to about 10,000 plans a year.
No, I thought it was 10%.
No, it's 10,000 plans a year approximately. So there's a very sizable number of people at any one time on a safety plan.
And the record supports that it's that big a percentage of investigations that result in safety plans?
Yes, that's in the district court's findings.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lear and Ms. Greenspan.